This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's the kind of announcement that's become all too familiar. Last week, Levi Strauss & Company said it will close its last two blue jean factories in the United States and three more in Canada. That will mean the loss of close to 2,000 jobs. The work is going offshore to companies in the Caribbean, Latin America, and in Asia. Despite the symbolism, Levi's, after all, are an icon of American hard work. The story got relatively little attention because the loss of manufacturing and blue-collar jobs has been epidemic. But while it's been especially bad over the past couple of years, manufacturing jobs have been dwindling here for decades, and not just in the U.S. Japan, Brazil, and even China are losing blue-collar jobs even faster. So what's going on? Some economists argue that, as wrenching as it is, the loss of American factory jobs is a sign of economic health and increased productivity. But factory owners and workers are not ready to give up. They say the government needs to do more to protect their jobs. We'll hear two views on that in a couple of minutes, and we want to hear from you, particularly those of you who've lived through this transition as workers or managers, and we want to hear how more efficient factories have helped, too. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we're going to start with a few of the numbers. Joining us from his office at the Conference Board in New York City is economist Ken Goldstein. It's good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be with you.
How many manufacturing jobs are there in the United States, and how much has that number declined in recent years?
Well, recent years are long years. You know, if you go all the way back to 1960, more than a generation ago, we had basically about 20 million blue-collar manufacturing jobs out of a total workforce of about 64 million, or something like a little bit less than one out of three. 40 years later, we only have about 16 or 17 million jobs in the manufacturing sector, but the total workforce is about 137 million people. So that for more than a generation, this didn't just start last week, for more than a generation, the only people who have gone to work in a factory in the United States is the first son to replace his father, who either got fired or quit or retired. Everybody else, all the rest of us, have gone to work in the service sector. It's been going on for more than 40 years. It's not going to stop tomorrow.
Now, all right, who is entering this workforce, this blue-collar force, if you will? Is the manufacturing worker the same as he or she was a couple of decades ago?
It's night and day. I mean, it's like the difference between medieval times and today. Because, 40 years ago, a lot of those jobs, not all, but a lot of those jobs were really rote, repetitious, mind-numbing jobs. None of that exists anymore, precisely because either the job has gone overseas or far more likely because a machine does it. So that the workforce in manufacturing plants in the United States today are basically technicians running the machines that are making all the stuff that you and I wear and use to get back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we mentioned, the United States is not the only country experiencing this kind of circumstance.
Well, the basic story is not that manufacturing jobs are too expensive to do in the United States. They are too expensive to do in industrial economies. In the United States, in Western Europe, in Japan, and in fact, even some of the places, and you sort of introduced this a little bit at the top,
mm-hmm.
Even some of the places where the jobs first went, they become too expensive there and they've moved. Some of the jobs that left the United States to go to Mexico have since moved on to Guatemala and Belize and so forth. It's a global process. It's been going on for more than a generation. It's not going to stop tomorrow.
And you see good and bad in this trend.
Well, I think in some sense the good, to the extent that it is good, is that nobody in the United States, or very few in the United States, have to do those kinds of mind-numbing robot, repeat operations anymore. On the other hand, all of that growth in the service sector, jobs that didn't exist in 1960, that's where we, all of us have really gone in a certain sense. And in some sense, we're doing the kinds of things that 40 years ago would have been maybe a hobby in the backyard or up in the attic or down in the garage. But today, some of us are actually doing those kinds of things, but getting paid for it. So on the plus side, a few fewer jobs that people absolutely hate, a few more jobs that people actually like to do and get paid for it, is sort of on the plus side. Obviously, that's not the whole story, but that is a piece of the story that we need to hold on to.
But you're losing, you know, towns, a way of life. Youngstown, Ohio, you think of.
You're not just losing towns, absolutely, I agree with that. And for people who have lost the job, this has been horrendous. But we're also, as I said before, the people who work in manufacturing are doing far more skilled jobs today. So that one of the other things that has happened on the negative side is we've lost some of those early rungs, if you will, on the occupational ladder, making it far more difficult for people having difficulty getting into the workforce to jump on a rung to be able to climb up and be able to, you know, as the old TV show used to say, move on up.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for being with us.
Anytime.
Ken Goldstein is an economist with the Conference Board, and he was with us from his office in New York City. Well, as we mentioned, we're going to hear two different views on this, and of course we want to hear from you as well. 800-989-8255 or email us, TOTN@npr.org. Joining us now are Fred Tedesco. He's president of Payted Spring Company, and he joins us from his office in Bristol, Connecticut, and it's good of you to take the time out today.
Good afternoon.
And also here in the studio with us is Russell Roberts, an economics professor at George Mason University in Studio 3A, and good of you to come in.
Good afternoon.
And Mr. Tedesco, let's start with you. Tell us what your company makes and how many employees you have.
Our company is a engineered spring manufacturer. We produce all forms of springs and stampings, wire forms, small assemblies. We work with engineering departments and our customers all over the country and in other countries to develop new products and ideas.
And what's happened to your company in recent years?
Since July of 2000, we've been definitely in a terrible recession. And we've lost, I had at one point, three divisions, our parent division in Connecticut, where we had 80 people. And then we had a division in North Carolina, right outside of Charlotte and Belmont, that we had 25 people, and we've had to close that plant in 2002. And I have a division in El Paso, Texas. Both the division in El Paso, Texas, and the one in Bristol have been downsized.
Are your customers buying fewer springs and such because they're having difficulty selling things, or are they getting them cheaper somewhere else?
No, the reason that I'm losing my business is because the very large retailers and the large manufacturers are forcing my customers to go to China and open up their facilities, and I no longer have an option to sell when they go to China. And I'll give you an example. One of our customers was a very large appliance manufacturer, and they had six plants in the United States. And they had three in Mexico. We served all nine plants. Today, they have no plants in the United States, and they have one in Mexico, and they buy all the rest of their stuff from China. Mm-hmm. And, like, one of their products was an iron, and the blenders and mixers. We made millions and millions of parts for them, but they could not meet the prices of the Chinese product, even though the quality wasn't as good, and the big Walmarts of the United States demanded that they buy their product from China. So it just comes over and it's sold here, but it's not made here.
Now, you formed an organization called MAD in the USA.
Correct.
What is that?
Okay. In 2000, I wrote a letter to every senator and congressman in Connecticut, North Carolina, and Texas. And in that letter, I had petitions from all of our employees from all three of those divisions. Everybody got them all, and I told them that I saw this terrible situation unfolding, and I had been watching it through Mexico for many years before that, and I could see that we were losing tremendous amount of manufacturing jobs and whatever, and I wanted them to do something about it. Not one senator or congressman, either of any of those states, answered me. So I got very frustrated, and as I watched the economy sliding and watching companies moving out, shutting down their doors and moving out, I decided I couldn't stand it. When I had to lay off our people and shut our plant in Belmont, my brother and I both literally cried over that many times, and my brother had to go down there and sit down and talk to people who had worked for us, done a wonderful job. We had the first employee we ever had there. We were there 20 years. He was still there. And tell him we could no longer hire him. Hmm. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever done that, but if you've ever had to tell people who've done a great job that they no longer have a job, they no longer are going to have their pension, they're no longer going to have their benefits, they're no longer going to have the security that they had after working very hard, it's a horrendous experience, and it wasn't anybody's fault. So I started this organization, Madden USA, of equal partners, employees, and small and medium-sized manufacturing owners. And immediately after I started, three other men came in, and we basically co-founded it together.
Okay.
And it's now grown to the point where we represent about 450,000 employees and owners, and very shortly we're going to be involved with well over a million people. And our goal is to wake people up, because there's another side to the story that was being said about manufacturing jobs and why it's okay.
Okay, I just wanted to give our other guest a chance. We'll get back to you, Fred, okay?
Yep.
Russell Roberts, we wanted to hear from you. In a commentary broadcast on NPR recently, you said the shrinking of the manufacturing sector is actually a sign of America's economic health. Explain.
Well, not to downplay the terrible personal costs that and human costs that Mr. Tedesco is talking about, which are very real. Another issue is, what is the impact on the economy at large, on the rest of us? And what has happened in the 50 years that our earlier guest talked about is manufacturing jobs have declined as a proportion of total employment. The reason that's happened is that workers in the manufacturing sector have gotten more productive. And that's an incredibly good thing. It'd be very easy to save manufacturing jobs in America. We could ban innovation. We could ban imports. Both of those things, stopping innovation and creativity and stopping imports from abroad, which is a separate way of tapping into creativity, both of those would preserve the manufacturing sector at its current size. But obviously we pay a fierce price. The fierce price would be that prices would be stuck where they are, there'd be no innovation, and new sectors wouldn't be able to be created. Because we've let creativity and international trade take place, we've actually benefited America by allowing fewer jobs to be in manufacturing, creating more opportunity outside of manufacturing for new job creation. As we've lost all the manufacturing jobs that people are talking about, total jobs have gone up dramatically over the last 50, 40, 30, and 20 years. And our standard of living has increased dramatically. It's not to say that it's good for everyone. It's hard on a number of towns, regions, as you've talked about. But as generations pass, the grandchildren and children of those people will have better lives. And I think that's the issue we want to talk about. Do we want a static world or a dynamic world?
Is this roughly analogous to the transition from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy 100 years ago?
Yes, in that case, it was very similar. It was mainly productivity change, not a mix of productivity and international trade. But in 1900, about 40% of the U.S. workforce was in agriculture. Today, it's about 2%. That sounds horrible. It's actually been glorious. We've gotten incredibly inexpensive food as a result of those productivity changes, the innovations in the agricultural sector. Farmers, through competition, have been forced to pass those savings on to us, the consumers, in the form of lower prices. That's freed up our money and resources to go create all kinds of jobs and industries we couldn't have had in 1900 or today if we'd preserved the size of the agricultural sector. Now, that transition was hard on some of the agricultural people, obviously. But I think the grandchildren of the farmers of 1900 are glad that we let the world evolve the way it did.
We're discussing the decline in manufacturing jobs in the United States and what should or should not be done about it. When we come back, you'll get in on the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the dwindling numbers of factory jobs in the United States and the effect of those changes. Is there a reason to renew our efforts to save factory jobs in the U.S., or is this something that we should let go? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Fred Tedesco, president of Payted Spring Company, and Russell Roberts, who's an economics professor at George Mason University. And let's go right to the phones. Our next caller is Armando, who's with us in Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi, thank you for taking my phone call. I love the subject matter, and I wish we'd talk about it more. I would like to first say that had we started looking into this subject more honestly 30-plus years ago, when people like my parents were losing manufacturing jobs in New Jersey to companies that would then move here to the South, we could have had some insight into what would occur then many years later. This is not a new process. The other thing that I'd like, there's so many things I'd like to say, but I want to ask this person with his version of economics that glosses over so much, what do we expect to do with all of the millions of Americans who depend on these sorts of jobs? I mean, where are all of these great jobs that we've produced outside of manufacturing? And that's kind of where I'd like to leave it.
Okay, Armando, thanks very much for the call. Russell Roberts, I guess that last part was to you.
Yeah, well, the caller makes a good point. The first point about the transition went north to south, and particularly in the textile industry and other manufacturing areas, and now it's gone overseas. And it's important to remember the net effect of that, again, on America as a whole. It certainly has been hard on a number of towns. But we've managed, for example, in the last 30 years to create tens of millions of jobs in all kinds of sectors that we didn't have in 1970. The internet's an obvious example. Telecommunications is an obvious example. Healthcare is an obvious example. All those areas are industries where employment in 1970 was a fraction of what it is now. We've had an enormous expansion, and some of those jobs didn't even exist. And we're able to have that expansion precisely because we can produce what we want to produce with fewer workers. And that frees up the people and the capital to create new things. It's not to say it's not hard on some people. And it may have been very hard on your parents, and I'm sure that was very hard on you. But for the economy as a whole, it's been very good. Now, the question is for our society, what should we do about the people who are hurt by that transition? Should we soften that blow? Should we cushion it? Should we encourage people to get more education and training? There are all kinds of things we can do. I think the thing we want to avoid is trying to impose some form of stagnation or some form of control that sticks in stone the number of jobs we have, or artificially encourages manufacturing or some particular sector, whatever the sector, in the name of some greater good. That greater good's not going to be there.
Fred Tedesco?
Okay. I have a different slant on this entirely. Number one, manufacturing jobs, manufacturing is involved in two-thirds or more of all research in the United States. And research is the forerunner, obviously, to new products and new industries. And the industries that the economist just talked about, a lot of those were fostered by the things that happened out of manufacturing and research. Right now, what's happening is, in addition to manufacturing going down, research money's going down, and it's also going overseas. So we're going to be losing the technology and the new products, so these other jobs that people are talking about aren't going to come from the United States. Number two, for every job that's in manufacturing, there's between two and five people supporting it. We just use the number two. If there's 15% of the labor force is in manufacturing, basically 45% of the labor force is in some form supporting it. And
selling those workers lunch or shoes or whatever.
That's right. That's a very substantial part of what's of the economy and manufacturing. People, yes, we do much more today. It's more technically advanced, and it's higher paid. So we are now having people that are being underpaid. Underemployed. Let me just give you an example. We have lost between manufacturing and the people that service. By the end of this year, it'll be 9 million people. And if you just figure 9 million people in a wage of $40,000 a person. Okay, and that's actually kind of low. And then you figure 35% of whatever that man makes for his benefits. That comes out to about $55,000, and that equals $500 billion goes into the economy. So then I asked our accountants to take a look and say, okay, how much would a guy with two kids, a wife and two kids, pay in city, state, and federal taxes. Never mind any other kind of taxes, excise taxes, sales mm-hmm. taxes, or whatever. And it's about 18%. That puts $90 billion back into the economy and helps to pay for the state. Plus, those people have their pensions, have their benefits, and are contributing to society. And then we take a look at the people that own the businesses that are no longer in business or no longer making money. And then that $90 billion becomes a much greater number because these companies aren't paying the taxes. And these companies are the companies that pay the taxes for the schools and whatever, all the other things that are involved. And I took a look at Walmart. Walmart sold $245 billion. Everybody says, look at all the savings we're getting from the cheap prices. Well, Walmart, the first thing that they did was they shipped over to Asia the low income jobs, and then said to people, look, low income people, come buy from us. We're going to take your jobs away, but come buy from us. Hmm. Now it's middle income jobs that they're sending over to Asia. They're saying, come buy from us. And that's a scam. But if you took all of the sales of Walmart, it's $250 billion. It's less than half of these people that lost their jobs. And Walmart doesn't pay $90 billion taxes into the economy. It pays very little tax into the economy.
I wanted to get a response from Russell Roberts.
Well, some of those effects are real, some of those lost incomes and some of the lost connected jobs. But that hides what's really going on underneath, which are the other jobs that get created because of the resources that are freed up for manufacturing. Just to take an example, between 1980 and 2000, 20 of the greatest years of economic expansion, we had a 19-year expansion from 81 to 2000 with a 1 year of decrease in 91. Basically, we had two decades in a row of very great economic growth. During that time, manufacturing employment fell 25%. And according to those calculations that we just heard, there should have been additional losses in jobs from jobs that supported the manufacturing sector. There probably were. But what we didn't see when we saw that, we saw the factories that closed. We didn't see the connection to the factories that opened. Because between 1980 and 2000, we somehow managed to create 40 million new jobs, net of those job losses. So I think what we're talking about here is a transition that is very difficult for the people affected directly. But for the people who are not affected directly, that transition is beneficial. That's not to say that we who benefit from it shouldn't try to help the people who are hurt. That is a legitimate issue. But I don't think it's easy to argue, as Mr. Tedesco's doing, that somehow the shrinking of the manufacturing sector has hurt the economy as a whole. In fact, it's been a time of great expansion.
Let's go to another caller. Tom is on the line from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right.
I can't believe that. I don't know where this economist lives, but the rest of us live here in the United States. All these jobs are gone. I've worked in the Northeast, and I've worked out in the West, and I've worked in shoe factories, and I've worked in woolen mills. You go into those towns, and you tell those people who are now out of work that they were boring and repetitive jobs. They supported themselves on these jobs, regardless of what the pay was or anything else. This is what they did for a living. Those jobs went south because of greed. They went out of the country because of greed. And as far as the farming, his comments on, you know, all about the farmer can't even put the crop in the ground and make any money off it. You go out to Iowa and some of these western states, and you see these people with all of their goods. It's like the Great Depression. All of their stuff is lined up on the side of the road for sale because they cannot make a buck. All right, but yet we can import the foodstuffs from Mexico and from other countries and Chile and all of that kind of thing, and we put our own people out on the street. So you get these manufacturing jobs back in this country, and watch how fast these people go back to work and how your economy springs back. It's just like the New Deal. What we need is another New Deal, okay? You can't – we've gone from a nation of manufacturers to a nation of consumers, and everybody's out of work. So now where's the money going to come from? Nobody's making any money. They can't buy any products.
Russell Roberts?
Well, two comments, one about the food and the other about the towns, I think. They're interesting. We do import food But it's usually for seasonal reasons, because we want to have grapes at a particular time from Chile or somewhere else. We're one of the, I think we're the largest exporter of food in the world. We're certainly a net exporter of food. But the more interesting point I think the caller makes is about the towns that haven't recovered. I have a friend of mine who teaches at Boston College. He grew up in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And the mills left Lawrence, and they went to South Carolina because it was cheaper. And then they left South Carolina. A lot of them went to China and elsewhere around the world. And my friend's mom said to him, "Isn't it a shame the mills are gone?" And my friend said, "Well, would you want me to work there?" And she said, "No, of course not. I'm thrilled that you work in a service sector job like education." But the real point is this. By letting those mills leave, we are able not just to make the choice more attractive between education and textile manufacturing, because all of a sudden there's no textile choice. The real point is that the other sectors that are available are now bigger than they used to be. So we see the shrinkage of the textile sector. We see the hardship on Lawrence. We don't see the expansion in the other sectors that's directly connected to it, but it's just harder to see. And that's the real benefit we get as a nation. And he's better off, and he's happy.
You know, the thing that the disconnect that you have, though, is you're not realizing that the manufacturing jobs and the research that are being done in manufacturing are creating some of those other products and some of those other things that you're talking about. You don't see the connect there. And, yes, manufacturing has evolved dramatically from where we were in 1960. I was here in 1960, and I'm here in 2003, and I've seen a lot of change. But I've also seen a lot of things that were impossible to do now very commonplace because of all the innovation and whatever. And to be honest with you, for all of the decades that in between, we grew. As we became more efficient, we actually employed more people.
We still are.
And what you're missing is, I told you, these people that are losing their jobs, you're talking about service jobs. Well, now we have IT people losing their jobs to China, to India. They're saying, well, we don't need that. We're having research jobs lost to India. We're having lots of jobs going overseas that were supposedly, that's the new place. There isn't going to be new places if we keep passing them off just for the greed. And that's a lot of what it is. So do I know how many manufacturing jobs it's going to take in this country to keep our economy going? No, I don't think anybody does. Do I think we could do more than 20 million? And would I think that would offer advancement to people? Absolutely.
But for 50 years, we've let manufacturing shrink as a source of employment, and we've watched our standard of living soar since 1950.
But it's always been a very substantial part of the economy, because for every manufacturing person, there's two other people working. So It's always been a powerful part of the economy. And letting it go and letting the research go is absolutely counter to our security. It's counter to our health. The other countries in the world are not going to protect us when we become less than a superpower. Part of the reason we are a superpower is because of our creativity, our ability to manufacture anything, our ability to produce new products and to defend ourselves. What are we going to do? Are we going to buy bombs from China to protect ourselves from China?
We're talking about the decline of manufacturing jobs in the United States with Fred Tedesco, the owner of the Pated Spring Company in Bristol, Connecticut, and Russell Roberts, who's a professor of economics at George Mason University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. Gary's on the line in Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi there.
Hi.
Look, I just wanted to address a few points Professor Roberts is making. And I totally agree that since 1950, we've seen an increase in the creation of jobs in many other sectors, and that lost jobs in manufacturing has freed up labor to produce, greater services and IT and whatnot. And that this transition of manufacturing jobs has led to lower prices for consumers. But I think there's a point to say that over that period from 1950 to the present, there's been a vast increase in income inequality in the United States, and I think that's an issue that should be included in this discussion.
Russell Roberts, is that right?
That's an interesting point. Most of the increase in that inequality occurred in the last quarter century, and it occurred all around the world, by the way. It occurred not just in the United States. It also occurred in Europe. It occurred all around the developed world, and that is an issue. Let me phrase it a different way. In 1950, if you only had a high school education, you had a pretty good standard of living awaiting you. Today, that's not true. At least it's not as true as it was then. It's not as good a standard of living compared to your peers who went on to college. In 1950, if you didn't finish high school, you could still make a decent living, and today that's definitely not true. So there's been a change in how skills get rewarded. Education, the premium that people earn for being educated, has gone up dramatically. The lesson there is to stay in school, particularly high school, and college if it's appropriate, but certainly to finish high school. In 1950, that wasn't so important. Today, it's crucial if you want to be integrated into the modern economy. So that's the way I like to think about that income inequality issue. For people who didn't acquire the skills today and are going out into the labor force, they're having a very tough time, and there is a lot more inequality for those folks relative to somebody with a college degree. And I think the lesson there isn't to protect manufacturing, to make sure we have jobs, repetitive jobs, say, for people with low skill levels. The lesson is to encourage the quality of our school system and to encourage our culture to encourage people to stay in school. That's the key to our prosperity in a more egalitarian society.
You also have to have a much higher degree of education to be in manufacturing, too. So
that's right.
We both agree on the educational part of of this issue. Our coalition is definitely for more education and whatever. But we have a country, and we're never going to be a world power without manufacturing. We are not going to just be a country of consumers. And I'll tell you, we're sending all these other jobs out, and I don't mean to be a wise guy. Everybody says, well, it's not so bad. We could send economist jobs over to India for $10 an hour, too.
We do.
You know?
We do that now. We do it in a reverse way. We have graduate students who come to...
When it starts to be that none of you guys have jobs, you'll start wondering, gee, this isn't very good. I'm making it at a point. It's all right when it's somebody else that's not being willing to be paid American wages. Americans have a part of their dream to go from lower class to anywhere they can by working hard and by getting an education. We're destroying the middle class here.
I don't think so. But the point I want to make before we finish is that I am in foreign competition with other scholars from around the world. They come here, they go to school, and they threaten my job. And I congratulate them. I salute them. They lower my wage. They compete for my opportunities. And I think that's a good thing. It keeps college education a little more affordable. I know it's sometimes a little expensive. So that competition is healthy.
And we're going to have to, I'm afraid, Mr. Tedesco, we're going to have to wrap it up there. But thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Fred Tedesco, president of Payted Spring Company, with us from Bristol, Connecticut. Russell Roberts, thanks to you as well. Economics professor at George Mason University. When we come back from a short break, the transition to digital at Disney. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.